From Crazy Hood Productions, I'm Jay Havana, and this is Family Ties. Today's episode is about Drain, a multi-talented artist, producer, and photographer. He's one of the founding members of The Awe, an OG Crazy Hood member. Listen close as he shares his story, from living overseas where he first discovered hip-hop, to meeting a group of individuals that were forming an alliance that represented Kendall and the Miami hip-hop culture. Always authentic, always crazy.
Another day, another dollar, my story to tell. Another failed piss test, I'm back to jail. Jail cells overcrowded with killers and thieves. Putting work, motherfuckers, roll up your sleeves. I'm Comptown representer, I'm letting them know. I keep it hood with a nigga, so hand me my dough. I don't play when it comes to bread or the raps. Instead, get to kill a motherfucker till his vocals dead. My crazy hood overthrowing, shut up. Nigga, you see the pistol showing from the CPT. Down with EFN, between the beef and the peace, local line is still line. The real and the fake, couple lies get in.
Who is Adrian Angingham?
Who is Adrian Angingham? First off, first generation Jamaican from East London. Lived there for 14 years. Moved over actually to the U.S. on my fucking 15th birthday.
Wow.
You know, that kind of sucks.
When you were growing up in London, is that, would you say that's where you first discovered hip-hop?
Definitely. Okay, I'll break it down for you as far as me and hip-hop goes. So, in my household, my pops, I can say he's Jamaican. So, I think after, when was it? Obviously, it's World War II, right? And if you kind of do your research, like, England and New York are kind of very similar, I guess, as far as, like, immigration and all that stuff. And, you know, so, like, you have, like, underground railroads in, like, New York. You guys, it's like it mirrors England almost type thing. Like, the building, the architecture, everything is very similar because, obviously, that was one of the founding states where, you know, the British had, you know, colonized and all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Boston, New York, things of that nature. So, everything is very similar. Buildings, everything like that. The architecture, the whole thing. So, like, after World War II, same how they were doing in New York as far as working on the railroads and all that stuff, there was opportunities to work on the railroads and the underground in England. So this is probably, I would say, in the late 50s to the 60s. So my pops and his cousin, they ended up going over to England, I think, in the 60s and shit. This nigga took a, I think he took a boat. Yeah, they took a boat back in the day. My pops was a rude boy. He was, you know.
Right.
But he had to go. Because he's Jamaican, but he had to go and provide for the family. And my pops dropped out of school when he was like 8 or some shit to provide for his family because my grandfather was a Rolling Stone, you know what I'm saying? So,
right.
So this was a common thing. So back then, like, my pops and my uncle used to DJ. So you got a bunch of Caribbean people, Barbados, Jamaicans, starting community in London, certain parts. And then my pops was like a DJ also. So that music kind of was always heavy in my family, you know?
Okay.
Like, my pops got, like, crazy vinyl collection to this day. He still got mad vinyl type shit. So, like, I was always around that. Like, my mom was telling me, like, the other day I wouldn't want to go to sleep when I was a kid. Like, him and my pops were just fucking kicking it, just listening to music in the living room, and I would knock out type shit. So, fast forward to that, my sister, my older sister, Dawn, obviously, there's always music in my house. Always music. And I remember the day, back in the day when you had radio
mm-hmm.
and a tape player, and you were fucking, you know, catch it, record it on tape, like whatever it was, like over there playing on the radio, record it.
Yeah.
And then I remember '82, I think it was around that vicinity, and I heard The Message. Mm. A Broken Glass, everywhere. That shit, my sister. Because mostly she's playing like a lot of red groove, like 90s, like, nah, not gonna be like 8th R&B, like Anita Baker type vibe, or, you know, Betty Wright type mm-hmm. shit, that kind of weird group R&B. And then she was rocking This Message shit, and I was like, oh shit, she was crazy, she was dope as shit.
Yeah,
that shit got on super repeat in my crib. Like, my sister was always rocking that shit. So later on, then going to school and stuff, and then like my friends were listening to more hip hop. This is like in the mid '80s, and then what movie came out? I think it was Beat Street over there. So in England, like stuff would come out in America, in New York and stuff, and you know, we would get it almost like a year after. Back in the day when movies came out here, it took like a year to go over there to England and other places and stuff. So I managed to get back in the day we had video stores, you know, my family, you know, like, oh, wow, we got a VHS player, wow, you know, that's a big thing back then.
Yeah.
And shit, and I think I was able to rent. Anybody who used to go to the VHS store, you was lucky if you got it. Like, usually the shit would be out of stock or somebody was renting it back in the day. Instead, you got the cover, and then they had, I think it was Beat Street. And yeah, I'm like, oh shit, so I grabbed that shit. I played Beat Street like fucking nonstop, man. To the point where, again, I got that tape player out, and I was recording that on my boombox, like some of the music and machines and stuff like that, so I fell in love with Beat Street, and started breaking and all that stuff, and then that movie Breakdance came out, Breakdance 1 and 2 with Turbo and Ozone, Ice-T was in that shit, I remember too, that shit got mad burned, so there's me, like, you know, pop locking and all that shit, mm-hmm. And then back in the day also, every Saturday, I think this was maybe in the late 80s, there's a DJ called Tim Westwood. I think he's still playing to this day in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have a set, strictly hip-hop stuff. He'd play the latest stuff over there. And then I would always stay tuned, record that stuff also. And then being around my boys, they started doing all that hip-hop stuff. Me grabbing cans of paint, doing dumb shit like big pieces of cardboard, spray painting in my fucking room, not knowing about the fumes and shit. Fucking, my mom's just like, keep that shit in there. Don't bring that shit out. You are sneaking that shit. So I'm like, like stupid shit. Like, I'm really poor. I can spray paint, but that's just me looking at all Beat Street and fucking, you know, Remo and all that shit. Like, thinking I can fucking, it's easy.
Right.
Type shit. So I also used to draw too. So back in the day, I started, like, you know, sketching out graffiti. I never spray paint, but I would sketch out the graffiti and all that shit and do little pieces for my friends and stuff like that. So the whole process of me coming to America, I ended up going to Philly a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time, right, I go there, and then my mom and my grandparents wanted to do something, go out. I'm like, I just want to stay. I specifically remember this. I want to stay and watch TV. I'm like, fuck that. I want to go out. I think I must be like 11 years old, by maybe 10, 11 years old. Not even, not like 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm flipping channels, and I see I'm freaking UMTV Raps for the first time.
And this is when you were still in England or here in the States already?
Yeah, I'm still in England, but I'm coming over to the States, traveling.
Gotcha.
I still have to do paper to fly back over. So I came over to Philadelphia, I think, twice before I actually migrated. And then I fucking saw Big Daddy Kane. Mm-hmm. I remember specifically mm-hmm. on that shit. But we still had, like, I was rocking in England with Tim Westwood, like, everything rocked him, heavy, and stuff like that. And, my sister used to rock, like, Bob Bates, rock all that shit, like, all the pop and stuff. But it wasn't until I was going to be rap, so I came over here, I saw Big Daddy Kane. And I was like, oh, shit.
I'm ready. Rapper stepping to me. They wanna get some, but I'm the Kane, so yo, you know the outcome. I'm not the victory, they can't get with me. So pick a BC day, cause you are history. I'm the authentic poet to get lyrical. For you to beat me, it's gonna take a miracle. And step into me, yo, that's a wrong move. So what you on, Hobbs? Dope a dog food. Competition.
That's a cool motherfucker right there. He was right. Dancing, he had the chick. He was flowing like I've never heard before. I got back to England, next day I went to the record store and I picked up the vinyl. It was like Long Live the King. And in fact, going to podcast, that same vinyl, that's the one I brought over. That's when I have how long I've had that vinyl.
Wow.
That Big Daddy Kane signed that shit. And I made sure I brought that specifically from England. That's fucking crazy. But that was actually like my first record I ever bought, I think, with my own money. Like when I was a shorty. So that's like, for me, when I started rapping, it was like Big Daddy Kane. That's the reason. I was like a super duper fan. So doing that, like in school in England, I was also kind of rapping, also and kind of imitating like American accent.
That's awesome. So you're like a Renaissance man almost of the culture. Like, you love the dancing, you love the graffiti aspect of it, and obviously the rapping.
The whole thing, like, I wanted to do it all, type thing, man. I just fell in love with, like, the culture, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Not even, like knowing about it, too. It was just fucking dope. It was fresh, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
What, when you heard, to go back just a little bit, when you heard the message, because it sounds like that was, like, your first introduction to hip-hop, right? Can you... Yeah. What do you think you felt as soon as you heard that?
It was just something like different, and it also had like the message, like, because I'm just used to listening to old like reggae stuff from my pops or like the old R&B with my sister, and then you got this guy talking about broken glass everywhere, people pissing on it. I know you just don't care, and it was like, damn, this motherfucker saying some shit, like. You know, it was refreshing. It was like new to us, and he had a message behind like the music. You know, it wasn't really no curse words in it. There's nothing but my mom and pops would really flip out about when we were playing that shit.
Yeah.
And then like with me, man, it sparked me. I like, I love music so much, man. I'm like almost like a slave to the freaking drum beat. Like, so you had this boom, cut, boom, 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 cut, like, and it was fucking dope. Like something that I've never even heard before, man. So I just kept on playing that shit like nonstop, man.
That's dope. When you were rapping, when you started rapping, I should say, did you really like sort of like pursue it, or was it more like just doing it for fun when you were like in England and then you transitioned to the United States?
It was more just for fun, man. I had my boy, his name is Stephen Clark. I remember that cat. Still got him on Facebook, and he played piano. Okay. And then we had a music teacher. Forgot his name. Indian dude, super cool, young guy. So he wanted to enter us into a contest. Mm-hmm. But they needed a rapper. And, you know, they knew I liked hip hop. I didn't rap like that back then. So I figured they kind of approached me because I had, like, you know, in England, I think the school I went to, I think there must have been maybe like five black people there, because the area that I would lived in,
mm-hmm.
and stuff didn't really have. I wasn't in a good area. Like my parents type shit. So
mm-hmm.
the school that I chose, hardly any black cats over there. So they picked me to go in this contest. In fact, Clark P, he wrote my lyrics for this shit. And it was something about school time. Can't wait to we can. So I was just freaking rapping on that. But I would like sound American, but I was British. So I would imitate, you know, the lyrics. So that's when I came back from Philadelphia and Torquay and stuff. So fast forward, moving to America. So for the first time I went to the U.S. I was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And then my uncle, he was in L.A. at the time. This is back in, I think, like 89 or something like that. So my grandparents eventually ended up moving over to California, Ontario.
Okay.
In the valley, because that's where, you know, they're developing houses and shit. It's cheaper, get bang for your buck. And then we ended up going over there. So I could have ended up in Philly if my parents were still over there, but we ended up in L.A. And that was in 1990. So, yeah. And from there, I stayed there for a year. Like I said, my parents are Jamaican. I had another uncle here in Miami. My brother spread all over the place. So, Miami's closer to Jamaica, you know what I mean? And L.A. was, I thought it was dope. I mean, California, I was loving it, you know, but, it just kind of disconnect from like the Caribbean life. So I ended up over here to Miami, and then went to Sunset High in 1991, straight to like 11th grade, and that's where I met like these fools, the Crazy Hood cats. You know, these cats will fucking tell you, as far as like my personality in the crew and all that shit like that, I probably are the most like reserved one, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while for me to get to know people and trustworthy and shit like that. So, you know, moving around and all that shit and California, man, I got friends and everything was cool. They used to call me England because my accent was crazy heavy back then.
Okay.
So, you know, eventually made some friends and stuff and, you know, all that good stuff. And then I got to fucking move to Miami. I'm like, oh, motherfucker, that fucking sucks. So, fast forward, I was just like freestyling this bullshit, but I was nice at freestyling for some reason. I could always freaking just go at it.
Mm-hmm.
I like practice and shower and all stuff. I would write lyrics, but I would never, you know, I've never been the type of gutter rap type thing like that. And then I think it was like senior year in high school that I think they had Howl Can I Be Down here, early 90s. I think maybe 92, if I'm not mistaken, the first one. And I think E, Paul, and them guys, they discovered it by accident on the beach, like with a bunch of rappers at a convention. And they're like, oh, shit. So the next year, he wanted to try and be a part of it. So he wanted to shop an app at How Can I Be Down and all that stuff and get ready for it and do a demo. So we always used to like freestyle in school and stuff and bullshit. And then I think he asked me if I would be interested to do it. And he'll put it in the studio and all that stuff. And I was like, yeah, I'm not freestyle, but I'm like, yeah, I don't want to. Because he was just messing around freestyle all the time and shit. And I was like, he wanted to do it. I'm like, all right, fuck it, I'll do it. So that, when after I got in the studio and got behind the mic, that's when I kind of more started taking it serious. But that's really all due to EFN. I was actually like the first rapper in Crazy Hood type shit.
Wow. When you came to Miami, when you started to really take it more serious with the rapping.
Right, yeah. It wasn't until I was actually in the studio and he put me in the studio.
Right.
And we all had our little crews back then. You know, we had CHP was still around. I don't think they had the name CHP, but we had that. And we had Hector's crew. I forgot the nigga's name. Underworld Elements and stuff. And we had our crew was like Poetic Simple. So you had cliques, but you were just a group of friends.
Yeah.
But you call yourself, you know.
Yeah.
Type shit.
Yeah.
That was all it was.
What was your crew name?
Poetic Symbols. Yeah. P-O-E-T-I-K. And Symbols with a Z at the end.
Symbols.
So, Poetic Symbols. Funny shit. So, but E, like I said, put me in the lab for the first time. We did a demo. And I'm like, I like it. People actually thought it was good. And I'm like, all right, man, let me take this shit a little bit more seriously. Type shit, you know?
Right. You mentioned earlier you've always been like a reserved person, still to this day. Do you feel as if when you get behind the mic, that's when you're able to just creatively and, you know, emotionally and just let it all out?
Definitely. Almost like, I was like referred to people where, like, that's like my alter ego.
Right.
Like, you got Adrian and you got Big Drain and shit. And honestly, like, back in the day, I used to freestyle, whatever, and like perform and shit. Like, I'll black out type shit, you know what I'm saying? And go in. Like, niggas, like, God damn. This nigga, reserve nigga. But I just fall back afterwards, like, you know. So, but definitely a form of expression, like I said, is I'm more like a creative cat, I think. Definitely, I don't like too tough being in the forefront. Honestly, it's not my personality. I'd rather just fall back and be in the background half the time. But it's either that, whether I was drawing or rapping, making beats, and now I'm doing like photography. So it's, for me, it's always something that's just a creative output. Like, you know, for me, it's almost became like therapeutic type shit. You know?
Yes.
If I had to go see a fucking shrink. So. Right. Yeah.
Hip hop to you is very therapeutic. When did you start getting into the production side of it?
It's a funny story on that one. So if you do some little more research on social media, you're gonna see everybody pretty much follows a guy called Nick Fury, right?
Okay.
So I always refer to Nick Fury as a sensei or Yoda. That's what I call him. Okay, I'm taking the rapping a little bit more seriously and stuff. And honestly, like my man E, I love my brother because that motherfucker was so innovative. Mm-hmm. He learned about credit back when he first graduated high school, because you know his pops is an entrepreneur type shit, so that's in E's blood type shit. So he's using his credit. He went into debt for the crew type shit, like all that shit was ringing up on fucking credit cards. So I ain't paying red cent. I already wanted to rap, but E put it on himself. He wanted to do it. He financed the whole shit, right?
Wow.
So I was buying studio time, this, that, and the other. So now, at that time, I'm in junior college, now, like the first year, and they have, we actually recording all this shit in Miami-Dade Community College and stuff, too. And my man, Nick Curry, is in, he was an engineer, and he was in the MIDI lab. He was one of the teachers in the MIDI lab, or the instructors,
okay,
type thing. So I was introduced to my man Nick through my boy, white boy Tony, one of my friends in my neighborhood. And then he liked our raps, and he helped us out with the whole the demo project. So when it came down to do the second one, right, I think we had a dude called Daniel. He called himself Devious, who did the production for that, but we didn't pay him that much. So second time round, well, I think Devious liked the way I flow, so we gave him a minimal check, but he wanted to fuck with me. So second time round, now I think he wanted a bigger check. He wanted more money, right?
This Danny guy.
So yeah, he wanted more money from E and shit. Nick was like, you gotta cut the check type shit, right? So
yeah.
He's like, you know what? I'm being a fucking bunch of ignorant fucking guys and shit. We're like, yo, fuck that. Shit's not that fresh, right? we some cheap niggas. Fuck you. We're going to do our own shit, right? So fuck that. So this is where we start freaking it now, right? Mm-hmm. Miami-Dade had this fucking engineer class. That's no prerequisites, but you take this fucking class, and they give you, how much is it? I think 12-hour, 3 or 4 3-hour slots to record in the studio with an engineer.
Wow.
Right? So you had to do pre-production, then you had to do the actual recording, and then you had to do the mix down type thing. So my crew's like, you're going to get busy. Everybody's going to get studio time. Get the class, like one credit. It was cheap, like maybe I think like $40 a credit or something like that back in the day. So you figure, all my crew now, we all got fucking studio time.
Mm-hmm.
Type shit. So now we have that part covered. Them niggas used to hate it, the engineers. Because we were fucking doing like fucking 3 projects in 3 hours. Like knocking that shit out, bullshit mixed out, this shit. Them niggas ain't getting paper, type thing, because it's a part of the school thing. And then I started, like, we all took the MIDI lab too. We said, we want to start learning how to make beats. And they had the S900 there, which is an Akai Classic Sampler, Master Tracks, and some other programs and stuff. So I'm started, like, mirroring Nick Fury and learning from him and watching him get busy. And then I spent so much time in the lab. Like, the whole crew's taking these classes. I'm probably the only one that really embraced it and went in with this shit and took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And then my man Dr. Rhodes, shout out to Dr. Rhodes, he was an instructor in Miami-Dade who used to do the music stuff, but he was real technical, sound waves, fucking all types of like frequencies and all that shit. He's a doctor. Mm-hmm. But he was applying his shit to the music,
right?
Shit, right? And theory. He seen me in a lab so much, he's like, yo, he pulled me to the side, like, listen, why won't you be a lab assistant? And I'll make a little like scholarship money also on there. You get a little check, but you gotta be in the lab, maybe, I don't know, maybe like 15 hours a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just instruct people, students come in, they want to work on any projects, you teach them what to do, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, hey, hell yeah, I'll do that shit. But the good shit about being a lab assistant is now I got 24/7 access to the lab, even when the school's not open.
Nice.
So I'm like, fuck, hell yeah. So that's it, I'm going in. Half the time when I was being a lab assistant, I wasn't even helping them motherfuckers. I was in my own zone type shit. So, like, they wouldn't even think I was a lab assistant because I was in my own zone. And I'm acting like I said, I'm acting like an asshole. I'm not saying nothing to nobody. Like, I'm in my headphones, freaking on this beat. I'm taking the S900 workstation and fucking freaking that shit. So, that's where I really learned how to perfect it. I couldn't afford my own equipment, right? So, once he put me me onto the credit card game and building up your credit. You know, when you go to college, there's a bunch of recruiters and shit, like, they want fucking credit card applications everywhere. Like, yeah. Shit, they want you to start credit.
Yeah.
So I used to, I forgot the name of the magazine, I used to buy shit on my credit card, like the Boss drum machines, right?
Mm-hmm.
I used to then record those drum sounds on a cassette individually, kick, boom, snare, boom, hi-hat, everything single on a fucking cassette. Then I used to return the drum machine because I couldn't afford that shit, right? And then I used to have all these sounds in cassette, and then I would take those sounds, whatever, and I'll go to the lab, and then I'll start making beats and shit. So my shit used to sound super dusty, like straight grimy, but it was dope type shit. So yeah. Almost used to fucking, it was crazy back then. It was almost like I can apply, like when I used to draw, like I would create a picture in my mind and I would have my sounds and then I would go to the lab and I would knock it out. And that's when I first started learning sampling and started chopping shit up. And back in the day they had, I think, was it Columbia House? You get fucking 12 cassettes for $1. Yeah. Shit, remember back in the day?
Yeah.
And then you keep the fucking package, like, fuck that shit, right? Yep. Then you want to freak it, so you put a different name down the next time. You do the same shit, boom, you get that shit, you keep it, right? So I always started doing that and getting mad old cassettes, like Barry White type shit, man, or all this old R&B shit. And then I used to, like, cut up samples from there, shit. So I used to, like, paint it in my head at the crib and then go down there. So I think in 94, 95, Nick Fury, he ended up getting the MPC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that changed the game completely.
Right.
This, it was like, had 22 seconds worth of fucking sample time, but he was fucking doing some crazy shit on there. And I was like, wow, I need that. Then he ended up, like, he bought the man's MP362. And Benny upgraded to the 3000. So I'm still fucking with the S900 in the lab. He brings his fucking shiny Akai fucking MPC 3000. I'm like, damn, that shit's dope. How much? $3,000. I'm like, oh, shit. I can't afford that shit. But my mom got great credit and I got student loans, right? So boom. I gassed to get the cosign for me. And I remember we went down to Space Music over there in North Miami, and I got myself that Akai 3000, right? MPC 3000. $3,000, right? My mom's like, yo, you better fucking pay the shit back. I swear, that's my credit.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting a student loan and then paying her back. So, hey, you pay me back already? I'm like, yeah, I got it. Don't worry about it. Like, I ain't owe my mom shit. I owe the credit card, not my mom. Fuck that shit.
So, yeah.
Like, I still got, I got a good 10 grand left on my student loans. And this is all fucking music equipment right there. That's what I learned about my student loan, what I could do with it. That was it. It was a wrap after that. So I got this Akai, and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing with this shit. But I'm plugging it into my boombox with the speakers, and it's like a foreign language. But I was, like, determined. So it was, like, night and day I was on that shit. I had my own shit at the crib now. I'm fucking boom. I'm knocking shit out. But I finally grasped it. And then that was it, man. You know, once I had my own drum machine, I just got busy. So it was after that. And then I think a few years later, they came out with the Akai MPC 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And because the MPC 3000 was just bare bones. I had to spend like another fucking G or so just to upgrade it to do like SMPTE, which is time code, which, you know, if you know what time code is, the MPC has 8 outs. So a kick is 1 out, snare, hi-hat, boom, boom, boom. That's all individual. So if you got like 12 tracks or 13 tracks of sounds, you would need a time code to sync it up when you're dropping it to 2-inch reel.
Right.
Or ADAT tape. I didn't have a SMPTE card in my MPC. Nick Fury did. So I used to give him my disc, and then he would help me drop it. And it got to a point where I didn't want to ask him for that shit all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Type stuff. So they came out with the 2000. So I'm like, shit, I could sell my 3000, and then I could, and the 2000 was cheaper, but it was smaller, but it was more kind of advanced,
right,
as far as the technology. So I ended up getting a fully loaded 2000, and I sold my 3000, and that was it. That was then I got, that's when I really started getting busy, when I got like a keyboard and started learning more about mixing down shit and compression, you know, outboard gear and things of that nature.
Yeah. Do you still have the 2000?
I still got my 2000. I would never sell that.
Wow.
I was been thinking, like, when I saw my 3000, it was kind of stupid, because that was, like, before the internet. But that's when the internet first kind of came out.
Yeah.
I remember my mom had, like, a bullshit, she would package shit, and then we'd be on these, like, remember these chat rooms and shit, so there was one as far as music equipment. And then some guy was going back and forth, he wanted my 3000, I think he was in Georgia. Which is fucking nuts. Well, I fucking send this dude my fucking 3000. It's not PayPal. It's just trust.
Yeah.
I send it to him. He could have jacked my shit. My man Andrew did the same shit. He should got jacked, but he ended up sending me the cashier's check. It wasn't no PayPal or nothing like that. He sent me a cashier's check, which is kind of nuts when I think about it. Like, that was kind of stupid back then, but that's it. I should fire that bitch up these days.
That's beautiful. After you got the 2000, that's when you started getting more into the production side. You got a keyboard. You remember what keyboard you got?
My own keyboard was the Roland XP30.
Nice.
Which I actually sold maybe like a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I got that, some sounds and stuff. So that's when I really started getting in my zone, like as far as like the beats. I'll just be in a room and just lock myself in there and just fucking knock shit out. And then what we used to do, like, at the MIDI lab is we had Fury, I think it was my man MIDI Lord, my man Pro, a few producers, like the beat nerds would be in the lab, and we would have a thing called like the face off. We were doing beat battles back then before they was even existed type shit.
Nice.
We call it face off type shit, and they just fucking play beats. So that's really what got me, because every fucking time I think I would have some shit, this Nick Fury would go and fucking smash me on some shit. Yeah. And just kill my beat. I'm like, this nigga. So I was always playing catch up to Fury, dog. So, but when I got in my bag with the 2000 MPC and really started freaking it, then I was like, yeah, got it. So there was like, it's like some super friendly competition, man. It's like, you know, still sharp and still type thing.
That's tight. So, from rapping as an influence, you had Big Daddy Kane, right?
Yep.
For production influences, who would be your producers you looked up to?
Well, definitely, as far as the flow influence, Big Daddy Kane, right?
Yeah.
And they go as far as from New York for some reason and shit. And I ain't gonna say, like, definitely Hov. I'm the biggest Hov fan. But I'm in the Hov since Jay kicking the A, kicking the way past Y. You so crazy. Like 90-91, original flavor of Hov. So, definitely on that shit. Almost to the point, but I used to kind of like try and mimic like the cadence and the tone and shit like that with Hov when I used to rap. As far as production, fucking Premier, Nick Fury, shit, Eric B, Marley Marl, like the Juice Crew shit, Dr. Dre.
Biatch!
What happened to baby? You look good now you carry. Long time I watch you, I want to chat to you. You go on like you don't want to chat to me. So what happened, Drea? Tell him what the fuck I go on now.
Creeping down the back street on D's. I got my Glock cock, cause niggas want these. No sooner as I said it, seems I got sweated by some nigga with a Tech 9 trying to take mine. You wanna
make that type of cat was really a big influence as far as my production on there.
It's a great list, man. That's a great list. It's a great list. Tell me a little bit about Poetic Symbols. How did you guys come together, and what was your guys' roles?
Poetic Symbols, honestly, was just a group of friends, man. Back in the day in high school, we all used to, like, go to this park called Sugarwood after school and play ball. So, you know, we had Crazy Hood, Eric and them guys, and we had my crew, Hector's crew. And I had one guy called C. Mage, my man Tony. And he always was the flyest nigga in high school, and he was rapping. Like, I used to be the one beating on the tables, like doing the beat. Mm-hmm. I think I wasn't rapping. Like, I used rapping, but I didn't want to rap in front of people. C. Mage, he ended up going to the Navy after high school, and he ended up getting, released a few years afterwards. So by that time, I'm in Miami-Dade taking the engineering classes. And then we already did do a project. It was Poetic Symbols was marketed in the demo, but like I really, like I said, wasn't really trying to rap like that. I wanted to produce. type shit. So D, we threw him up in the mix. Then I used to rhyme. That's when we get the first demo, and I was like the second Hagen Ivy down. Let me go in, and then I think I started doing my own demo, my own beats too, and I wanted to shop shit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's when I'm trying to get my boy Poetic Symbols, just like before the all that shit. Okay. Symbols, this is still a Poetic Symbols demo. So I think we worked on the next demo, and that's when I came up with that shit that Pun ended up taking. Still not a player. It's what's the name of that? Betty, I think it was Betty Wright, Rose Colored Glasses. And I've heard this song since I was a shorty back in England. Always loved that piano. The dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And then I think I had my pop playing one day in the crib. I was like, oh shit, he had the vinyl. I'm already stamping now, man. I'm getting that shit. So that bitch. And that's when I think I was in the lab system still. I think I ended up going there, taking it, recorded it on tape, took it down there, and I had that beat and stuff, man. And that shit was a fucking, just a dope ass vibe. But maybe I pushed it out, maybe somebody heard it. I don't know, maybe it was just a coincidence. It's like, you know, it happens, I think, you know?
Right. Right. And was that the only beat? Because I remember when we were in LA, we were talking, like, you guys had mentioned, like, there was, like, some other beats, maybe?
Yeah, then we had another one called Starshine, but that was on the actual All album. And that one, I think Royce 5'9 ended up snatching that shit. And that was on, like, I think a Barry Manilow sample.
To all you thugs doing dirt out there, getting locked, put the blame on everyone else, huh? But it's your fault. All you girls be the neighborhood sluts, cause how you want and how you talk, plus the cash you fuck, you need to change.
In fact, if you go in that fucking Who Sample app,
yeah,
where they fucking snitch on people, I think my name was up on that shit, or somebody found out what the fuck I used or some shit on one of them tracks, man. But yeah, that was that one. Damn, this, I know this, there might be another one. It's just that I just had a good knack of fucking picking out dope samples, you know?
Right.
So, shit happens, you know? It's not like it's our music. Somebody else created it. I get it. So, you know,
right.
I let that go. So, as time passed on by, I kind of, honestly, me and Tony kind of fell out. D wasn't really taking the shit seriously. Like, it was really, really just like me. So, we had three MCs, me, Danny, and Tony. But I guess I consider myself, I guess the leader of the crew, you know. But, you know, life happens. He had a baby. Tony just fell off. So I was really the one that really kind of took shit seriously type thing, you know. So
what's the transition from Poetic Symbols to Crazy Hood?
After the Poetic Symbols stuff is done, we've always been cool. But Crazy Hood was more like Paul. We had Ivan and Jair, Steve, my man Donuts, Mission Humphrey, Mission a few others, type stuff. So that's my family, but we still have separate crews, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now I think Hector wants to freaking, these guys are in a competition, but it's Weird Thoughts and Hector, the offensive DJ, and I'm making beats now, I got my NPC. So they need beats and production.
Yeah.
So they're hollering them, you know, obviously that's my family right there, that's my boy, so, you know, but it was like, all right, so Drain, we need beats. So we're like, all right, I flipped them. I think the first one that we pressed up was Live and Uncut and Fake Out of Towners. Even through that transition, it's the Alliance is the name, right? But I kind of got one foot in, one foot out
right.
of that shit. Like, I'm not fully committed to Crazy Hood, because I still got my crew,
mm-hmm.
type thing. So, throughout that transition, I think, you know, spending more time with each other, and then it was just like, dog, I'm always with you motherfuckers, like, I'm Crazy Hood. Like, yeah, you're Crazy Hood. So, you know, that's it. You know, it kind of was like a natural kind of, like, transition into that shit. Like, I've always been there. I never just kind of fully repped it until, like, I was like, fuck it, I guess I am pretty good. But I didn't want to rap mm-hmm. back then on the project. I just wanted to play the back and be the producer and shit. So, gotcha. The whole premise of the Alliance was, like, we got, like, the head of each kind of crew. crew, which was like, you know, Craig Hood, the Fanman, had me poetic symbols, and had Hector with Underworld Elements, and we formed the Alliance. So that was the whole premise of the all of the Alliance type thing. And then it was eventually like, you know, Dran, you're part of the crew, so it's like, fuck it. I'm like, cool. So and then throughout that, that's when he started bubbling on the mixtape circuit and started doing these intros. He wanted niggas to see boys to rap on it. And he just needed an extra person, so I guess he convinced me to fucking start rhyming again on these mixtapes and shit. And then that's it. I just started rapping type thing. So, because if you notice now, like if you listen to the Alliance album, like the whole shit was like produced by me, except for I think like the intro and the last track with Nick Fury. But I'm not like on every song as far as rapping on there. And I think I even have a solo song on there because I really didn't want to fucking rap, dog. Like, I prefer to stay in the background and just do the beat. Yeah.
And with the Alliance, you guys made, was it one album or?
One official album, and we did on a bunch of mixtapes, and then I think we did a few mixtapes. I think the biggest one was the one where K-Slay had hosted. That one that came out. But we, one album, dropped a few singles, and then of course we had the album where we had Nori on there. That's crazy.
Gotcha.
And then that started getting some burn on the radio station and shit like that.
Yeah, you can see me in Miami with EFN. Scoop me at the airport with some guns and some hands. I am such a creepy, you know the L Icky up in LA.
So you were talking about the Alliance. You guys got together. You're making music. You release an album, and you have Nori featured on it. And then that's when you guys start creating that buzz. I want to capture that moment from your perspective. How was it during that time?
Dope, man. Obviously Nori is getting hot in the industry. Just to have a guy like that featured on like a single was kind of like, it was a big deal, you know. That whole process too was like fucking nuts, because I specifically remember that fucking beat. Because at the time now, I'm still going to school, right? Mm-hmm. College, trying to get my bachelor's, and then I had to set up in the bedroom. We had studio time. No, what happened was we recorded That's Crazy without Nori. He's supposed to drop his verse, right? And I think I didn't even have the beat, man. Or whatever I was making, I didn't like it. So I think it was like a Sunday morning, I got like a horn stab, and then I started fucking with the echo, and then that shit just fucking blew. And I fucking knocked that beat out in like 10, 15 minutes. You know, it's a banger when my mom pops in the bedroom. She's like, yo, I like that. Like, okay, cool. Yeah. So I said, boom. My mom never say that shit. Like, yeah, I like that. And so I'm like, I think I got the beat. So moving fast forward to that shit, like, fucking Nori ends up coming to Miami because he's down to record this shit for us, right?
Right.
But then he gets fucking, he's on Tommy Boy. He gets fucking, he has to do a session regardless. I think he was doing, because N.O.R.E. already dropped, so he was doing the Reunion album.
Okay.
So he goes to Hit Factory in Miami, right? And I never been to Hit Factory. And we did this shit on Tommy Boy's fucking dime. Like, Nori's like, fuck it, come in, bring that shit. So I think Hit Factory had fucking, it's so old school, we had 2-inch reels on this shit. We dropped the fucking beat on that shit. They already got 8-deaths in there, some shit like that. So the guys wiring that shit up. Yo, that shit sounded so dope on these big-ass studio speakers and shit. And I was, like, in awe, like, we had verses, but we didn't have no fucking no hook. Nigga Nori came up with a hook and like fucking electronic, not even pop. Go for the fucking hook. And no lazy going. I'm not scamming along, and that's crazy. I'm like, oh, this is fucking dope. DJs. We was getting spin on the radio. They started doing shows. It was an awesome feeling, man. Like, finally putting in this work and getting, like, some recognition. And, you know, Kendall, man, in Miami, there was still a lot of haters back then. A lot of niggas sleeping. A lot of niggas, like, hating the fact that we had a relationship with Nori and shit. So I know the niggas were expecting the album to be fucking trash, right? And then, you know, and I'm like, fuck, I got pressure for that. I'm mostly using my beats. Niggas ain't gonna like my beats. Like, fuck. But it came out good, man. And, shit. Didn't get any bad reviews. Like, everybody was kind of shocked at what we was able to pull out, man. So it was good to finally kind of get recognized. And then, you know, other local casts and people started reaching out to me and wanted me to make beats for them and shit like that. So it was definitely that's a dope feeling right there.
Wow. That's awesome, man. What does Crazy Hood mean to you?
Crazy Hood is family to me. That is my boys. Not even call my boys. They're my brothers. It's bigger than it's hip-hop. It's family. At this point, we've been rocking for fucking more than half our lives, man. So if shit ain't going nowhere. Even if hip-hop wasn't involved, it would still be the crew, you know what I'm saying? So, Crazy Hood to me is like one of the forefront cats in Miami that, you know, were through the hip-hop Miami scene, you know, done it all, man, from promotion, music, mixtapes, everything, man, like, cats know the name. As far as Miami is concerned in the hip-hop scene. And also us not faking it, you know, we represent Kendall. And he's like, oh, that's a suburb, but shit, whatever. That's what we're going to represent, you know what I mean? So That's it, man. Crazy Hood for me is a crew, just a family.
I know, like, the phrase Drink Champs has been around longer than what people know, longer than the podcast itself. You know, I know you guys used to hang out in the studios and, you know, at the end of the night, like whoever like survived it or whatever, you guys were the drink champ and you guys would call each other that, you know what I mean? How has that transition been? It's like another spark, another big moment in your guys' career. How's that been?
It's so weird. It's because this is what we've done already, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost seamless to me. Like, because back when we had the office in Kendall, too, like you said, we had the XM show. The niggas wasn't getting paid for. I mean, at the time, Nori was in Kendall. Living for life. And then we do this XM show, but it was the same shit. Niggas getting drunk, popping shit. And we always pop shit, because that's the thing. We've always been around each other, popping shit. And bagging on each other and shit like that. It's just that now we're recording it on a freaking podcast and everybody else is listening to it too.
Yeah.
And we got fucking, you know, yeah, so it's kind of surreal to me because it's like, it's not even a big deal because when you're around it so much, you don't really realize it, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's weird that way. So, yeah, man, it's a blessing too, man. It's a blessing that we kind of evolved with the times and, you know, always when people count us out, you know, we're like roaches. We like, we're never going to die. That's it, bro, you know?
Right.
Like, niggas thought we were down and out. That's cool. When we came out, we're fucking coming home.
Yeah.
And that got on revolt. But it's like, oh, shit, damn, they're doing it against us. So,
yeah.
And then when that starts dwindling down a little bit, seeing it start getting quiet, fucking Drink Champs comes out. Boom, like, oh, damn, these niggas again, like, what? So, you know, timing is impeccable. That shit could have came out like 4 or 5 years ago, but it wasn't time. But G always had that vision for it. And then finally Nori grabbed the concept of a podcast. And it was just great timing, man. I think the Drink Champs was to come out today in 2018, 2017, it would not have had the same type of impact as it did when we came out a couple of years ago.
It's really, really dope that the crew has been able to evolve within the culture, you know, evolve from, but still having that that foundation of hip hop and brotherhood and loyalty and passion. You guys evolved from the Alliance to Crazy Hood to film, from music to film, and now and then to podcasting. So it's, you're constantly evolving, which is amazing, man, because not a lot of people, I mean, you look at the industry, like, there's not a lot of people that can reinvent themselves and continue to push and continue to be a voice in the culture.
And that's why I was saying, like, probably cats are like, especially right here in Miami, like, damn, these niggas again type shit. But you gotta understand, like, nobody wants to kind of hear a fucking, you know, early 40s rapper at this point. Like, and I'm like, but these crews that came and they were rapper crews like we were, that was all they knew. They didn't think outside the box to do other things type thing, you know. Yeah. And in this case, with Dee and the rest of the crew did, we kind of, like you said, evolved into other aspects of the culture. Like, you just didn't stick to fucking rapping type thing. Like, you ain't gonna be trying to pop off to a major label after fucking 15, 20 years of rapping. Like, enough is enough. Like, sorry, bro. Yeah. Give it up. Like, it's different for a producer. That shit is easy. It's timeless. Like, you can be a fucking 50-year-old producer. As long as you're banging out some shit, you good type thing. But the rap is a little bit different. You know what I'm saying? So, thank God, like, you know, he thought of these things, like, and that's just, honestly, just being true to the culture, man, you know, and, right. and having a love for hip-hop, you know, and knowing that shit, there might not always necessarily be a check behind it, but it's something that you love to do, you know what I'm saying? So you're always going to do it. And eventually, like, as long as you work at it, then opportunities arise, and it's up to you to take, you know, advantage of those opportunities, you know?
Yes, yes. What does loyalty mean to you?
Loyalty is very important. It's knowing, let me rephrase that. That shit is so important, just to know that somebody got your back, unquestionable. You don't have to question that person's actions or anything. You can almost, like, you can rely on that person, you know what I'm saying? And especially for me, well, I'm the youngest of three kids. I got two older sisters. I never had brothers, you know. So this is who I consider my brothers in Crazy Hood, you know. Right. And the cats you see now, like I said, we've been rocking for 20 plus years. Like, the loyalty is unquestionable. Like, it's, you know, we loyal to each other. You know, it's very important. Shit, man. You know, like, you can almost predict what people are going to say type shit, you know. But that's with years of friendship and knowing these individuals, man, you know.
Right.
And, like, you can imagine, like, we got chicks to go to high school where they fucking straight hating.
Right.
But they fucking petty. And they don't have their friends no more. Like, damn, y'all still together? Like, yeah, motherfucker, yeah. We still, like, know what it is, but we've been rocking this long since fucking high school that we probably at least see each other on a weekly basis. Maybe 2 weeks might pass, but daily text messages or actually just physically seeing each other, because, you know, we used to have THP Wednesdays. We used to have every Wednesday we just going to the office to meet up.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying? That was mandatory type shit. So, and so to this day, like, fuck, man, 25 fucking years plus, bro, we've been seeing each other every fucking week. Like, you're fucking, damn, that's fucking nuts when you think about that shit. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of people have that shit, man. They don't have that type of, like, friendship and loyalty, man. So I'm honestly so blessed to have, like, a bunch of those that I consider my brothers, man. Like,
yes,
I really appreciate that, man.
So what's next?
Got some good plans. Hopefully we can execute it as far as, like, the coming home stuff is concerned. Drink Champ stuff is amazing. And what we're doing with that, but definitely I feel, and that's going to be off record or on record, whatever, like that, man. Like, this nigga D has done so much for myself and the crew, and he's a humble motherfucker, and I don't think he toots his own horn. He needs to do it more, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, if anything, for my goal, like, I got my brother back, man. I want to get Brandon for this dude. I want him to get him out there, man, because I feel that he could be out there so much more, man. He deserves it. You know what I'm saying? The podcast is a great platform for him, but I would love to see him out there, man. Like, he can really DJ. Like, if you want a fucking night set, yo, that nigga can kill it, man. So,
yeah.
I would love to see him out there, man. Like, I know he fucking hates this, man. He's fucking talking about it, but I would like to just see that brand, EFN, get out there. Dude's articulate, he's very intelligent, man. Like, you know, and honestly, like, at the end of the day, like, I get it. Like, in order to push this crazy hood movement even further, I kind of need him to get out there, man. And dude's so humble, because a lot of people know him, you know, so.
Yep.
But ultimately, the better he do, the better the squad does.
In our next episode, we meet another member of the Crazy Hood family, Eddie Giggs, a lifelong hip-hop fan whose hustle and creativity and guerrilla marketing helped expand the Crazy Hood brand. Tune in and listen to his story. New episodes of Family Ties come out weekly. Family Ties is a Crazy Hood production. This episode was produced by DJ EFN and myself, Jay Havana. Our theme music is titled Southwest by DJ EFN, featuring MC8, Blue, and Cam, with production by The Guild. If you like what we're doing, please rate and review us on Apple Podcast. It helps new people find out about the show. Also, check us out on Audio Boom and CrazyHood.com. Always authentic, always crazy.